We cover a whole range of topics on this show and hope that you find many of them useful. The subject we're going to cover now is not always an easy one, but it's important and can even be life-saving. April is National Prevent Child Abuse Month, and we're happy to have Cheryl Cato back with us to talk about what each of us can do, what you and I can do. She is a child and family therapist, director of the Rainbow Project. Great project. It's a child and family counseling and resource clinic in Madison. She's also a clinical adjunct professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And Cheryl, what a pleasure to see you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm really glad to have you back to talk about this very topic, this very tough topic to talk about sometimes,
yes.
Isn't it? Yeah. And I know you've done a lot of work in this area for many years. What are the different types of child abuse? There's more than one kind, for sure.
There are. And I think most typically people are thinking about physical abuse, and that certainly is something that is prevalent. Unfortunately, 3.4 million referrals to child protection agencies are occurring. That's 6 referrals a minute. Nationally, every 10 seconds, really,
wow.
A report is made. So that is more typical. There's also the condition of neglect, which I think can be more difficult to actually prove. And we're not talking about poverty. We're really talking about a much more chronic, unsafe environment where there is little or no supervision, as well as malnourishment. There's sexual abuse, child sexual abuse, as well as emotional and verbal abuse.
And, when you have those kinds of abuses, the long-lasting or the lasting impacts on a person who experiences this as a child can be awful, I would think.
It really can be, and I think that much more now in research is showing that brain development, neurobiology is also impacted by trauma. So it really is something that is important to recognize and to also remedy right away. And I think that, the bad news, we need to know and recognize that. Otherwise, we're not really going to be able to address these issues unless we're aware. But the good news is that there are interventions that work,
mm-hmm.
and that can really turn things around if recognized early.
And we're certainly going to talk about some of those today. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. You may be a survivor of child abuse. I appreciate you sharing what helped you heal, what we need to know about supporting victims and survivors. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions or your comments or your experiences right there. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. What services and support do victims and survivors typically tell you that are most important to them?
Well, I think because I'm old, I have had the gifts of children coming back as adults to say, this is what I remember, and this is what helped. And I do know one very important thing is, and especially for young children who are more normally very self-centered, and they're supposed to be at that young mm-hmm. age, truly believe that they are deserving it, that they are really to blame for the abuse. And so when that is not challenged, that can be very devastating and can be a lifelong difficulty in their relationship and their esteem and their ability to fulfill their own personal and social growth. But it really is a full spectrum and range in affecting development and affecting, as I mentioned, brain development and neurobiology, of being able to regulate their ability to even have emotional control and control of their behavior, as well as their ability to trust and develop close relationships. Oftentimes, intimacy can mean hurting. So those are some of the things that become distorted many times, and almost reinforced if their behaviors are physically aggressive because they're acting out because that's how they were treated, then they often get punishment or rejection from that behavior, and the cycle continues. They're not learning what they should do instead.
And the services and support, I mean, the Rainbow Project is, I mean, maybe you should talk about what you folks do, because you do some wonderful work.
Well, thank you very much. We are celebrating 35 years this year, and we have served over 10,000 children, young children. We work with children, infants through 11 years of age, and we also work with caregivers. And that could be biological caregivers, as well as we have a program. We have 11 programs. One of them is grandparents, who are primary caregivers of their grandchildren, for example. And we've worked with over 9,000 adult caregivers and offering trauma work, family work, dyadic work, to really address sometimes attachment, grief, and trauma together when you're working with younger children. And it really has been shown to be very effective.
And so that's a great service that exists right here in Madison. In general, what services and support is out there for people around the state, perhaps?
There are many wonderful services, including hotlines and warm lines, that are really there to really respond to folks who may need services and support immediately to just cool down, have questions. There is, through United Way, 211. Services, and there are those that are more preventative, support groups, parent education. Many times with young children, young parents in particular, what are realistic expectations about when should a child be toilet trained? And if they are unrealistic, that can create more stress as well.
So 211 is a number that you can use?
Yes, that's the United Way.
The United Way number. Judith in Wausau has something for us, so let's go to her. Judith, hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Sorry, but I beg to differ with your speaker, who was speaking of neglect and listed sexual abuse as a part of neglect.
I'm sorry. That was not even in the same sentence. I was describing neglect, and then I mentioned other forms of child abuse.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, because it really is a form of physical abuse and can be horrifying and cruel.
Yes, and I actually think it's the least reported because of the shame. And there are some stats, one in four girls and one in six boys. I've heard some varying things through the National Victim Assistance Assistance Program, but I do know that that is definitely a very serious area of physical abuse that we work with every day.
I used to work in both domestic and sexual abuse, and I would say it also is often unreported because it can be hard for an adult outside the house or the whatever situation it may be occurring in to detect it.
Yes.
Because it's so hidden.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You don't see often bruises and scars and cuts, and you know what I'm saying.
That's so true.
You don't see injury.
That's so true. That's so true. And and there is also research showing, too, the co-occurrence of domestic violence and child abuse, as well as sexual assault, is high. And there are some studies as high as 60 or 80%.
Wow.
Unfortunately. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thank you, Judith. I appreciate your call. We certainly wanted to get that straight. If there was some misunderstanding there, we definitely wanted to have that straightened out. Kathy in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that I'm in my 60s now, so what happened to me in my childhood, you know, is maybe not what's happening now, but my home life was very stable, but there was physical abuse. I think in part that was because of the way my mother in particular was brought up with, and it was what she knew, and out of frustration, That was how she disciplined me as an only child. But I don't know where it came from, but I know that when my husband and I decided to have children, I mean, it was something that I did not want to repeat. And, you know, for some reason I was able to not perpetuate that that possibly learned behavior. And so, I mean, I do think there's an opportunity for people if, again, like I said, everything else in my home was pretty stable, and it was just that physical, you know, physical yeah. abuse with hangers and belts and you know, things like that. But it, you know, I think because the home life was stable overall, that gave me the ability, the inner strength to realize that, you know, I could change this. And mm-hmm. I realize that's not the same for a lot of people if there are a lot of dysfunction in their home environment.
Yes. Mm. You bring up a very good point. When you are abused, it isn't necessarily a predictor that you will automatically repeat that cycle. And I do think resiliency is really critical. And we look at the strengths of an individual before, during, and after a traumatic abusive event. And the chronicity is one thing, but it is also looking at those strengths of the individual that can have. I've testified in court, and when judges have asked me, well, why is it after this history, this child has been able to really break that cycle? And I do refer to that kind of resiliency and other people that may be in their lives that have reinforced and supported them to be able to overcome some of those barriers.
Yeah, very good points. Kathy, thank you very much for calling.
You're welcome.
I appreciate your call. We're visiting today with Cheryl Cato, child and family therapist, director of the Rainbow Project. It's a child and family counseling and resource clinic here in Madison, Wisconsin. Also clinical adjunct professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And we're talking with her about child abuse. This is National Prevent Child Abuse Month. That's how it's worded. And I know we're going to talk about how survivors can learn new models. Maybe we can take that up in a little bit. And certainly we want to take your questions and comments, too. We'll take a quick look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. And then we'll be back with our guest. You stay with us. Each and every child deserves to be safe and feel loved. But sadly, many are the victims of child abuse, and it can have long-lasting effects. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. April is National Prevent Child Abuse Month, and we're very fortunate to have Cheryl Cato with us to talk about what you and I can do and what resources are available for victims and survivors. Cheryl is the child and family therapist. She directs the Rainbow Project, that's the Child and Family Counseling and Resource Clinic in Madison, wonderful clinic. She's also a clinical adjunct professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And Cheryl, thank you again for coming by today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me here.
It's great to have you here. And we have many, many callers online. And I know that they're eager to talk with you, so let's take a call or two and see what's up. Jeannie in Illinois, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I had a one-time episode when I was 8 or 10 that affected me for my entire life, and I just wanted to bring attention to the fact that it's not always adults that would abuse a child, but it can be another child who might be disturbed.
Yes.
I had a cousin try to assault me at a family reunion. And at the time, you know, you're taught as a good little kid in the 70s that you don't fight, you don't do these things.
Mm-hmm.
And although I was wrestling with him, I never called out. Instead, I was trying to reason with him and saying, why are you doing this? What's the matter with you? And it was like talking to a wall. He had dead eyes.
Mm.
It's an extreme case because I didn't mention anything to my family until I was in college. When he and I were both grown up, he was a year or two older than me, and he came from a rather rough side of some folks that had married into the family. His mm-hmm. father, we did find out, was abusive, but he grew up to be a killer, and he killed several women. And I had a little bit of survivor's guilt when I finally came out and told my family years later, and Mom's like, I thought I watched you kids like a hawk. But to notice my sudden extreme need for personal space, mm-hmm. and my wariness to have anyone come up behind me, and my absolute will to fight, because when I did escape, I took a vow at 8 years old that no one had ever touched me again without a fight.
Mm. Oh.
And I took self-defense, and I did knock a few guys down a couple of times. The first guy that tried to kiss me ended up getting thrown on the floor.
Oh.
So it definitely affected my life down the road. But at the same time, it also gave me some wariness to help friends in difficult situations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I impressed upon them the need to trust their instinct. I didn't report it at the time because with their family being a little more rough and tumble than ours, I didn't think anybody would believe me. They said, oh, it's just boys being boys. No, it wasn't. He was dangerous, and my gut said, yes, he's dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for calling. Cheryl, I know you have some comments.
Well, it really shows how powerful even one incident can be. There can be strengths from coming from that, and the fact that you're able to help others who've been in similar situations is actually a strength. And some of the work that we're doing with evidence-based trauma-informed cognitive behavioral therapy, we actually encourage victims to think about a trauma narrative, because one of the things that happens is you carry that around. You could be in a very crowded room, but feel very alone, and it separates you from everyone else. And so in safe ways, it's important to be able to tell that story and then be able to tell others so that something good can come from something very, very tragic. And this person has done that already on her own. And I do think that there are some things that can come from that can make you stronger. But it also shows us what we can, on a very primitive level, that we may not be able to measure even in our brain scans yet, what very primitive things are affecting us in terms of survival when we have those kinds of events that put us on an alert and trigger us sometimes when we're in different situations, and then we're right back there again in that fight or flight.
Mm. Jeannie, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Nathan and Eau Claire, it's your turn next. Nathan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
And what's on your mind?
Well, I'm first a little story, and then I'll ask my question. My wife used to be a nanny, and she watched a little girl and a little boy during the days. And one day, the parents came home, and my wife was just talking with the father. And the little boy comes up and says, Nanny hit Emmeline, his little sister. And after a short conversation, it was, figured out that he was saying that to get her in trouble. He kind of thought that she would get a timeout, something very minor. But it scared her enough to quit her job. So what can adults do to protect themselves from false allegations?
Wow. I think sometimes being the there are those moments, teachable moments for people that they need to know that sometimes children may actually accuse people that are the most safe to them because they're afraid. We haven't talked about that, but why kids are not able to disclose, there are many, many reasons. And one is that they're often threatened if they do tell, and that they're also afraid that, as the former caller was talking about, that they wouldn't be believed, because you suddenly feel you are a part of something that's wrong, and you have that sense of it. And so there is a part of it that is actually astute socially, but really that's why we encourage people to talk about it, and children to talk about it. But I think, there are limits to that in terms of how you might protect yourself. I know a center in a state that I did a training in, decided they were not going to be hiring male therapists anymore because of the fear of the accusations that might come. And I think that's a shame, because sometimes that group of population may have needed all the more positive male role models. Mm. And so how far do we go? We certainly need to make sure we're trained well. I don't know if that person or the father would have carried things out anymore. They would need to weigh who you were and weigh the balance of who they believed. But I am worried sometimes that we become so restrained that it immobilizes us to do things that I think are really important. And I'm not sure I'm adequately answering the question. Were there more kinds of things you were looking for specifically?
No, I just kind of wanted to raise it. I know it's a hard question to answer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of, maybe you had an experience or you just knew something a little more, something more than what the general populace knows. So.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. It is a very difficult. And there are certain, I can think of even in my own experiences, I have to advise students. I have 100 students that I advise, and typically what I do, I have in my office, the advising table and chairs are by the door, and the door is always open.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as a sort of a preventive kind of measure that I really never shut the door.
And there are many other, unfortunately, I mean, we do that when we go traveling now. We have security, and there are some things we need to do in terms of background checks. But I know that certain centers where there are diaper-changing tables, they now have full-view mirrors, I mean, windows that you can see through. So, or even in faith-based communities and churches, they'll have a rule about 2 volunteers always on traveling. If they're transporting folks, kids. So those are some safe things to do in terms of careful hiring and those kinds of things, too. But conversations as well, I think, are helpful.
And again, Nathan, thank you so much. Myron in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, how you doing, Larry?
Good, appreciate the call.
Well, you know, I've just got a statement, too. I look at the psychology of child abuse like the psychology on the war on drugs. I mean, this thing just keeps a lot of people employed. For what reason, I couldn't tell you. Now, we have a lot of legitimate cases where kids have been neglected and abused, and we also have people that look at things from their point of view as to what is abuse and what's considered abuse.
Mm-hmm.
You can have somebody who yells at a child and that's abuse. I mean, I look at my own life and say, hey, it's a lot of times I deserve to be yelled at. It's a lot of times that I deserve to get my butt spanked the way it did, because if I didn't, I wouldn't be here to talk to you guys now. Some of these things are just things that children and adults need to learn to go through life. I mean, if you don't know how to be ridiculed sometimes, you don't know how to take criticism from people, I mean, what does that do to you as you become an adult?
All right. Thanks, Myron, for calling. I appreciate it. Cheryl, comment.
No, I think that these are good points, and I hope that folks aren't interpreting some of the things that we're saying, that I'm saying, as being yelled at here and there. And I think what we're looking at is really chronic patterns where there is definitely going to be damage. I do think that... again, the resiliency work is important to look at, because the absence of sound relationships and loving relationships is really the inoculation against a lot of these things in terms of, if this happens, what is that child like in terms of their support and family support before, during, and after any of those kinds of traumas. They're going to have the resiliency there to buffer that.
Mm-hmm.
You have had that love and attention. And so there's balance. But when there isn't balance, I'm just trying to help you imagine, when you don't have that and you have the other only, that's when you have problems, because they don't know the alternative ways of connecting with others or solving problems or expressing themselves. That's the part that's destructive. Yeah. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, Myron, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Could I just say, too, that after 35 years, what I think I am the last person to see child abuse under every rock, so to speak. And because of that, we know the difference between that. And so does the medical world when they're doing their investigations, when people are concerned, oh, will this be suspected of? They know the kinds of injuries that reflect more of the abuse. So I'm hoping that that is something that people aren't seeing as a trend, that every minor thing is being looked at that way.
We have other callers online, and I want to bring up a point here from a caller who said that his daughter, who lives in Marathon County, can hear child abuse going on in the apartment next door.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to help but doesn't know what to do. What would you advise, Cheryl?
Well, that actually happened to me many, many, many years ago, and I just decided to make an anonymous report, so they don't really necessarily know that would be you. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a choice. It's never going to be comfortable. Mm-hmm. And you have to think about, is this a moment when that's something that I feel comfortable doing or not? And you can do that anonymously.
Who do you call?
The child protection line that they have for reporting. Every county has that line.
So the 211?
No, this is every county would have a different...
Oh, every county would have a different line.
Number,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. So that... But you would definitely... You would not hesitate to do that.
Well, I think I'd have to know the specifics. I think it's important for us to not be the ones to do the investigating or determining. The law is that if there is suspicion and it is something that you're concerned about...
You've been, you know, you mentioned 35 years, so you've seen, and you talked earlier about the thousands of families and individuals that you've talked with. Have there been a lot of changes in over the years, or is it kind of just repeating itself year after year?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think that awareness always brings more recognition, that let's intervene early before it gets too serious or too hard to stop, particularly with the brain development. 6 years old and under are the highest risk for post-traumatic stress disorder. And so we really need to get in there early during the time that the brain is developing. But I think the other... trends, I think, have been attributed sometimes to the economic, the layoff. A long time ago, during the auto factories closing or the farms folding, there were then trends of increases. When you have those kinds of economic stresses, that many things, including substance abuse and other things, are heightened. And there's also the reality that sometimes healthcare and other kinds of things that are supportive are taken away or lost. So that creates more stress, certainly with domestic violence. So I think it is not to underestimate that you would say everyone who is in poverty is at risk, but it certainly is not helpful when you don't have access to quality child care and other kinds of resources. That makes it even more difficult.
Our daughter, when she was a baby, she cried at night, and you could not get her to stop crying. And there were two of us and from, an affluent family here.
And that's very stressful.
And I wondered how it was even possible for someone to not have breakdown under the stress. If you're alone or if you don't have the financial resources, it's just got to be so, so hard. I felt a little more empathy.
Yes.
I mean, nothing happened, but you were to the point where you just at your wit's end.
Mm-hmm. When you don't have the resources emotionally yourself as well for what kinds of things to do when you don't have that support.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Karen in Grafton, it's your turn. Hi, Karen. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to say when you had wanted callers to call in about how they had handled their situation.
Yeah.
I'm 46 now, and I was abused physically by my father. He would hit us with the bell to put us in the shower naked while he would hit us so that if we urinated, it wouldn't make a mess. And simultaneously, I was abused by my brother, and it is incredible how it gets into your life now, you know, 20, 30, 40 years later. And I just wanted to bring that up, that how have I dealt with it? I've thought I've dealt with it fine, but now as these people have passed away, I'm left questioning things and wondering, and it's spilling into my marriage, my children, and it does. And so I'm thinking that I need to get help and go to these resources and speak with someone so that I understand these feelings and I know how to communicate them.
Mm-hmm. 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 I truly believe it is never too late, and you have the wisdom already and objectivity to understand where you are in that, and that is in itself a wonderful strength.
Right, and for those listeners out there who are listening and they've coped maybe by, you know, working real hard, getting educated, you know, really poured themselves, being strong and concentrating on that, it's still with you, and it's something that if you should work out and don't ever feel ashamed to speak mm-hmm, with someone mm-hmm. and tell your story. You are a testament of survival.
It is. It is courage. It really is courage, and I really do respect your
advice. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing
that.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it very, very much, Karen. Dawn in Sharon, Wisconsin, we'll give you a chance here in the last couple minutes. Hi, Dawn.
Hi.
And what?
I adopted. Oh, I apologize. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. Tell us your story.
I adopted 5 children that were in foster care. Older children. They were 7 to 14. 7, 9, 11, 12, 13, and 14. And they were not only abused before foster care, they were also abused in foster care.
My
comment is that I feel so blessed. I went through an agency called Wendy's Wonderful Kids, Wendy's Hamburgers, the Dave Thomas Foundation,
mm-hmm. yep.
for older kids adoption. And I adopted them as a single mom. I'm a professor, so my schedule is a little flexible. But I could have never done that without the support of family, people like you who are on the air right now, who became their family in days, but my children still have PTSD, still suffer from, you know, they were sexually abused too, so suffer from fear of dating the other sex now that my daughter's 19. But it's a miracle. They've gone from somber, you know, won't look you in the eye children to laughing, sarcastic, funny, great, cool. I mean, so I just want to tell you a tragedy that turned into a miracle.
Oh, wow.
Well, and just kudos to you.
I guess so.
I think that when we're hearing about some of these tragedies, it's important to truly remember that folks like Robert Anda and his fellow researchers are, you know, showing that despite that, despite the kinds of tragedies, very young children too, and older, if exposed to persistent, consistent nurturing, it can actually change neurobiology, it can change brain development, and it is important to think about that. And I really applaud you for hanging in there.
Don, thank you so much. That is a wonderful way to end today, although I wish we had more time. Dawn, thank you. Cheryl, thank you. I hope you can come back much sooner than the last from your last visit. So please feel free. You're always welcome here.
Thank you, and I thank the callers too.
Cheryl Cato, child and family therapist with the Rainbow Project of Madison. Thanks to her, and thanks to you for listening. And please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.